Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. That's what's at stake, folks, the free world. We are joined by one of the most heroic figures in that war over many, many years. His name is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, United States Army retired. A decorated hero of many special operations and other missions over many years, the author of a number of very important books addressing some of his exploits and related subjects, including Never Surrender and two marvelous works of fiction, Danger Close and Kiloton Threat. General Boykin, we turn to you with regularity to help us understand some of the more incomprehensible things that are going on, particularly at the moment. The truth about the nature of the attack that took place in Benghazi, Libya, on the 11th of September of 2012, and what the administration has been saying about it almost ever since. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir. What do you make of it?
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you. Listen, we've been lied to, first of all, and I think that what our U.N. secretary was saying, our U.N.
ambassador
was saying, Susan Rice, I think was very calculated and deliberate, and it was deception. This was a planned terrorist attack. There, even the liberal media is acknowledging that now. It was it occurred on 9/11. Oh my goodness! I mean, how could that have been a coincidence? And it was stimulated not by some video that nobody has ever seen anyhow. It was stimulated by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, who released a video only a day or two before the 9/11 commemoration, admitting that we had killed Abu Yahya al-Libi, one of the senior operatives in Muslim Brotherhood, and a drone strike, which they had not acknowledged up to that point, and he also called for retribution against the United States. So that's what stimulated this. It was a planned attack. It was orchestrated as a military operation. They used a number of military tactics, including direct and indirect fire, fire and maneuver, multiple attack fronts, and this was a military terrorist attack. And there was what you have to ask, first of all, why was the ambassador in Benghazi with no Marine security guard? The second question you have to ask is, why was he in Benghazi at all on the 11th of September? And, the third question you have to ask is, why didn't we heed the warnings we had, particularly in open source intelligence? Frank, I could have told you that was not the day to be in Benghazi, particularly without a security guard, just from open source. And you and the people around you and a lot of other people knew that there was a dangerous place for our ambassador to be on that particular day, particularly to be unprotected there.
General Boykin, let me come back to the lying bit, because as a former senior military officer who served in a number of intelligence capacities, you had access to the highest levels of intelligence. You were intimately involved, particularly as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for intelligence in the George W. Bush administration, and the flow of intelligence and the translation of intelligence to policymakers. What do you make of the fact that we're told within 24 hours the intelligence was quite clear on the character of this attack, as you've described it, military, professional, effective, lethal, and yet for days after the administration continued to propound this idea that, no, it was some video, as you say, not very well viewed, but nonetheless, it's playing in really to the meme. And General Boykin, you, among other things, have also contributed mightily to our understanding of the threat posed by Sharia, specifically in a book of that name, Sharia, the Threat to America. What does this mean in terms of the administration's seeming interest in advancing this kind of Sharia blasphemy agenda? Is there a connection there?
Well, first of all, as I said, you know, you don't have to be a great analyst to figure out when Zohairi releases a video like he did and says, attack America, that something's going to happen on the commemoration of 9/11. Now, that said, what we're seeing, Frank, is that we have politicized our intelligence community. And the fact that our president receives less than 50%, I've seen estimates as low as 38% of his president's daily brief, which is the highest level brief that is offered in the United States on what's happening all over the world. And of course, he's been in the campaign mode and hadn't been paying attention to that. And so I don't think the president knows what's going on, but there are a lot of people in the State Department and other places that, with any reasonable analysis whatsoever, would have realized that was a dangerous place. Now, the intel was there. I mean, again, open source intelligence. The intel was there to know that something was going to happen, and there would be some reaction to Zawahiri's videotape that he sent out calling for a retribution against America. Yet nobody warned, either they didn't warn the ambassador or the ambassador ignored it. And he certainly has to take some responsibility for being in that place at that time. But what we're seeing here is intel has been politicized. And this is a cover-up for a failed U.S. foreign policy. And that policy began with going into Islamic countries and apologizing for America, which in the minds of those who want to destroy us showed absolute weakness. It didn't show any strength whatsoever. And historically, that has elicited a very strong response. And those responses have generally been responses in terms of going on the offensive, in the attack mode against us. So I think that it's a failed U.S. policy and is trying to cover it up.
Well, I hope you're right that the president is simply ignorant of what's going on. My fear is you look around his administration, you look at what the administration has been doing specifically with respect to the so-called Istanbul process of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. You look at the Muslim Brothers that it is allowed to hold influential positions at the State Department and with the OIC and elsewhere. My concern is that, General Boykin, we've actually got a president who is sympathetic to trying to find some way of accommodating the Sharia blasphemy demands of the Islamists, despite, you know, the tenor of his statement at UNJ.
First of all, I totally agree with you. I was saying that in that specific incident, he may not have even known that that Zawahiri had released this video and called for a retribution against America because he doesn't take his daily briefs. But no question that he is sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood and to what they're doing both in North Africa and the Middle East as well as in the United States.
Yeah, it was really chilling to me, and I imagine to you too, when you heard him say at the UNGA that the future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. It's just redolent of the worst of these bad guys. General Boykin, I've got to move quickly, and we've only got about a minute and a half left, to one other topic. Our friend and frequent contributor here at Secure Freedom Radio, Bill Gertz, has written a very troubling piece in the Washington Free Beacon today concerning an attack on the White House military office that's in charge of the president's nuclear football by Chinese hackers. What do you make of this?
China has been at this for a long time. China has two very troubling capabilities. One is their ability to hack into our networks. The other is their ability to use lasers to potentially knock out our satellites. We are so dependent upon the internet and our satellites to be able to just function daily, but particularly to execute warfare, that this is not a new thing. They've been doing it for a long time, and it is a very, very troubling trend. We need to take a stand on this, and we need to put the Chinese on notice that this is that they cannot continue.
Yeah, we're going to be talking more about this with Gordon Chang a little later in the program. I know he will share your concern and mine, General Boykin, that these kinds of capabilities, some of them asymmetric, are very much aimed at trying to neutralize our capabilities, and it's particularly worrying when it's aimed at our nuclear deterrent, especially. General Boykin, thank you, sir, for your extraordinary service to our country, past, present, and future, and for your contributing to our understanding of the dangers we're facing in this program and elsewhere. Keep up the good work, sir. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Ambassador Yoram Edinger about the view from Israel, the UN General Assembly, and elsewhere. Straight ahead.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have the privilege of being joined once again by one of the most astute observers of what is going on in the Middle East. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He formerly was responsible for congressional relations in the Israeli embassy in the United States and served as Israel's consul general in Houston. He is currently the director of a marvelous initiative called Second Thoughts. And the author of a marvelous series of newsletters called The Jerusalem Cloakroom. Ambassador Edinger, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you, sir.
Thank you.
Your prime minister was the center of attention, I think it's fair to say, at the UN General Assembly meeting last week, making very effective use of a somewhat crude but nonetheless highly evocative symbol of the Iranian nuclear weapon program and how it's progressing. Many took away from it principally the thought that his own sense of red lines has now been pushed back by perhaps as long as 6 to 9 months. What's your reading on what Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted to communicate to his global audience on that occasion, And has this bullet been dodged for that long, do you think?
Well, it seems to me that the Prime Minister's target audience was not the global community. It was the USA, and not only the president, administration, or Congress, but primarily the public, which has the ability to impress upon Congress and the administration to undertake the proper steps. The message to the American target audience, in my mind, was twofold. First of all, that we're not dealing with a threat limited to Israel, but a threat which, in fact, primarily aims at the U.S. and a nuclear Iran would devastate the dire American and not only Israeli interests. Secondly, the importance of red lines in light of historical track record. In fact, one could add to the Prime Minister's chronology of historical red lines September 11. If President Clinton would have drawn and would have stood by red lines after the series of Islamic terror attacks, whether it was in Khobar Towers or Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, whether it was the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, certainly the U.S.'s call in Aden, if the U.S. would have reacted to these events in a determined, disproportional, devastating manner, maybe September 11 would have been avoided. The same thing with regard to U.S. and Kuwait. We all remember, or some of us remember, the tragic exchange between then Ambassador April Gillespie and Saddam Hussein, when Gillespie basically told Saddam Hussein, "We don't have any red lines." And that was the major impetus to the invasion of Kuwait, which led to the first Gulf War, which led to a series of unfortunate developments. And it seems to me that that was the lesson of Prime Minister Netanyahu to the U.S. Red lines must be established, red lines must be adhered to, and in fact, refraining from drawing red line paves the road to war, and drawing red lines could spare us for the same thing, by the way, as the actual military preemption. Those who oppose military preemption against Iran are literally paving the road to a dreadful, maybe even global war. Those who support military preemption, in my mind, would also spare humanity of that dreadful war. Mm.
Ambassador Yoram Edinger is our guest. We'll be speaking more momentarily with Robert Zubrin about the implications of all of this for our own security and economy. So we'll come back to that subject with him. But sticking with the question I put to you, Ambassador Edinger, I very much take your point that history is replete with examples of where a red line once drawn or preemptive action, if necessary, is taken. It can spare the world grave consequences. Tell me what you make, though, of the widespread perception that if Bibi Netanyahu has drawn quite literally a red line, he has pushed it off into the future in a way that some of us frankly found surprising.
Well, if, and it's a big if the goal post has been relocated, then we're in for a very big time disappointment. However, first of all, we don't need to assume that the rhetoric of Netanyahu does prevent a military preemption before spring or before summer of 2013. Maybe, who knows? We are in for a major preemptive surprise. But secondly, we cannot ignore the reality
that the battle against nuclear Iran takes many, many forms, and possibly there has been success in slowing down the Iranian process. The bottom line, however, in my mind, should be adhered to, namely, no nuclear Iran at all cost. And once we realize, as I have contended long ago, that diplomacy or sanctions only play into the hands of Iran, once that is shared by the U.S. Administration, then military preemption would be the only way to stop nuclear Iran.
Our guest again is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. He's joining us from Israel. He is the director there of a marvelous initiative, the Second Thoughts Initiative. And Mr. Ambassador, let me ask you two questions. We've got about 3 minutes left. I want to make sure we cover both, and unfortunately, neither would be done justice, but you do this so well. Tell us about the concern that Israelis feel at the moment at the prospect that Syrian chemical weapons and perhaps even biological weapons may be migrating from stockpiles in Syria into the hands of, well, Hezbollah, perhaps, maybe Hamas and others on the one hand. And if you could, very quickly, an update on what is happening on Israel's southern border with the Sinai.
Well, on both sides, there is concern of military systems and non-conventional military systems in the hands of terror and rogue regimes. What we have seen in the Middle East in the last two and a half years with the tectonic, stormy Arab winter or Arab street is the complete fragmentation of Arab societies, complete lawlessness on the Arab street, and that could facilitate access by rogue terror regimes to non-conventional chemical, biological, and who knows, nuclear systems. And once again, it leads us back to Iran. And nuclear Iran today, where the nuclear is in the hands of a government in Iran, could tomorrow produce nuclear Iranian systems in the hands of rogue terrorist Muslim Arab organizations, all the way to Venezuela, Bolivia, or Ecuador in America's own backyard.
Yeah. And with them, the proliferation perhaps of the means of delivering them over long distances, ballistic missiles, which we're hearing the Iranians are intent on deploying in Venezuela. There have been reports that Scud missiles have been captured from the Syrian regime by the so-called opposition, which seems to be made up largely of the Muslim Brotherhood and maybe al-Qaeda. So a very, very dangerous witch's brew indeed. And all of this coming at the same time that the Sinai is becoming militarized and more dangerous as well. Mr. Ambassador, you are in our thoughts and prayers, as are your countrymen. I hope that you will continue to keep us apprised of your perspective, which is always brilliantly articulated and often very, very distressing indeed. Godspeed, sir, and we'll talk with you again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Critics of the Iraq War have long insisted that President George W. Bush misled the American people by pretending that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction in order to get us into a needless and unjustified war. The meme went, "Bush lied, people died." It wasn't true. George Bush believed what senior Democrats and U.S. and foreign intelligence services believed at the time. Saddam Hussein had used such weapons previously and had not verifiably eliminated either his remaining stocks or the capacity to make more. What we now know, though, is that Mr. Bush's successor did disinform the American people, denying that a carefully planned jihadist attack in Benghazi, Libya, killed four American diplomats on September 11, 2012. Will those once so insistent on presidential truth-telling now say, "Obama lied after people died"? This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize checks mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Robert Zubrin, a man that I am very pleased to call a colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he serves as a senior fellow. He is also the founder and president of Pioneer Astronautics, an aerospace R&D company in Lakewood, Colorado. A man of many parts, both an energy security expert, the author of Energy Victory, Winning the War on Terror by Breaking Free of Oil, and a man who has given much of his life to thinking about and advocating on behalf of planetary exploration, including with his book, How to Live on Mars. Robert, here at home, I'd like to focus for a moment on something that you have warned about, I believe, last week concerning what you call Obama's Iran policy risking a global crash. Tell us what your concern is there and how imminent this problem may be.
Yeah, well, look, here's the situation. Iran is building an atomic bomb. We know that for sure. They're mass-producing 20% enriched uranium. You only need 3% enriched uranium to make reactors. So it's bomb material. Furthermore, contrary to the opinion that has been voiced by many commentators, you don't need to go beyond 20% enriched uranium to make a bomb. While the U.S. military prefers 93% enriched uranium, if you have customers that are not so picky, you can certainly make one with 20% enriched uranium. And at the rate that they're producing it, the Iranians will have enough 20% enriched uranium to make a bomb within about 10 months, by my calculation. Netanyahu says 6 to 10 months. Either way, it's not far off. Now, Obama is not doing anything to stop it. The sanctions are mostly for show. The Iranians have doubled their rate of production. Furthermore, according to the New York Times, Obama was approached from someone within the American national security establishment who suggested that we take out the power plants that power the centrifuges that are making the bombs. And he rejected this, saying he did not want to do anything that might harm ordinary Iranians. Now, what that means is that deterrence is off the table as well. If you're not willing to do anything that might harm ordinary Iranians, you have no deterrent. So the idea of containing Iran through deterrence after they have a bomb is out. So this leaves Israel in the lurch. What can they do? Their options are limited. They could try to take out the bomb sites themselves, but that requires bunker-busting bombs. The U.S. could do it with ease. The Israelis could take a whack at it, but they'd only have one chance. It's not reliable. They could take out the electric power plants, but they couldn't keep them out, unlike the U.S., which could easily do so. So what does that leave them? The option of hitting Iran's oil export terminal at Karg Island. This handles 80% of Iran's oil exports. It's a soft target. It's a bunch of oil tanks. Could be set ablaze by a few hits. This would bankrupt the Iranian regime, stop the bomb program, and in fact probably end the regime because they couldn't meet payroll. But then what does that do? That will send oil to at least $150 a barrel and potentially more if the Iranians retaliate by hitting similar soft targets in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So this is what Obama is setting us up for. He's setting up a global economic crash precipitated by a high oil price. In 2008, oil went to $140 a barrel, and the world economy crashed as a result. This is what we're looking at right now because this president is unwilling to stop Iran from getting the atomic bomb.
Hmm. Robert Zubrin is our guest, and he is speculating on what might happen if Israel is obliged to act unilaterally against an Iranian nuclear threat by going at the sort of soft underbelly. Robert, if the effect of these actions and reactions, as you say, might be to shut the Strait of Hormuz or otherwise reduce the flow of oil, there has been some talk. In fact, I spoke with Boone Pickens about this last week on the show, that this would be relatively minor in terms of its impact on the United States because we only get 2% or so of our oil out of that region. What would the effect be, though, as a result of this disruption on the oil supplies to the rest of the world? And obviously, you've indicated prices would go up. But give us a sense of how this crash really hits us, even if it's a bank shot, starting with our allies.
Well, it's irrelevant that we don't get our oil directly from there. It's the world market, the world economy. If you can crash Europe and Japan, you crash the U.S. economy as well. And that's what it will do. $150 oil, or even higher if they succeed in retaliating against the other Gulf nations, will crash the world economy, and that emphatically includes the U.S. economy. In 2008, we lost 5 million jobs when oil went to $140 a barrel, and that had nothing to do with American oil supplies per se being cut off. It had to do with the world market itself being inadequately supplied.
Right. You have, in other writings, Robert Zubrin, spoken very powerfully about the dangers of the restriction of our own energy production and development of sources here, as well as alternatives to some of the more traditional energy sources. You've indicated, Robert, that this is a design of the Obama administration at the same moment that it is setting us up for potential economic dislocation or a crash overseas. Give us a sense of what it's doing to our own energy supplies and the development thereof.
Well, they put a moratorium on oil drilling in the Gulf. They've maintained all sorts of regulations that slow down domestic drilling on land. They're essentially blockading Canada by blocking the Keystone Pipeline. Look, what could be more anti-American than a move to keep Canadian oil off the world market? The United States is the largest oil importer in the world. Our national interest is lowering oil prices. You keep Canadian oil off the world market, you're assisting OPEC in raising oil prices. I mean, this is an economic warfare action directed against the United States.
Yeah, I guess we are seeing some of that oil at least being put on offer to the Chinese. So theoretically, it won't be off the market at all together, but it would certainly not be to our benefit.
No, the Canadian leader made a bluff. He says, well, we'll just sell to China. It's going to take years to build a trans-Canadian pipeline. In the meantime, the Canadian oil is off the world market. And even then, once it gets on the world market, its price will be elevated by the transport cost. So all this works in the interest of both.
Right. Robert Zubrin is our guest. He is the author of Energy Victory, among numerous other books and myriad articles. Robert, quickly, one of the things that you have been championing, particularly in your splendid book, Energy Victory, is the possibility that the United States transportation sector, which is the principal user of these imported oil resources, gas and diesel, could be diversified to utilize methanol, which we can manufacture from all kinds of things rather inexpensively and rather quickly. Tell us why that is and how quickly and how inexpensively and what a difference it might make.
Well, methanol can be made from natural gas or coal. We got plenty of both. Its current price on the world market is $1.20 a gallon with no subsidy. And any current car can be made to run on methanol. The computers that all cars currently have are capable of flex fuel operation. Unfortunately, that program has been disabled on most of them by the manufacturers in the United States for reasons that they need to explain. I suspect it's because of Arab buying into positions within those companies. I know, for example, that Volkswagen is 27% owned by Qatar. But in any case, that program could be activated, and then all you need to do to make them run on methanol is to change a few seals. I did this with a 2007 Chevy Cobalt. We got 24 miles to the gallon running on pure methanol, which on a dollar per mile basis is equivalent to getting 60 miles per gallon on gasoline. And if the administration was to move on this by, one, backing the open fuel standard that would require the automakers to activate the flex fuel capability of their cars, and two, getting the EPA out of the way, the EPA has banned the sale of methanol fuel above 5% concentrations. It's incredible. I mean, methanol fuel was pioneered by the California Anti-Air Pollution Agency because it produces much less pollution than gasoline. And yet here's the EPA stopping people from selling it.
It does smack of a conspiracy to keep us energy dependent and very vulnerable, as you've said, Robert Zubrin, to the sort of economic warfare that could really do incredible harm to whatever recovery we have and, needless to say, to the national security as well. Robert, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We appreciate very much your superb work. Keep it up. Keep coming back to us, if you will, on these and related issues, as you are a font of information about what we need to be doing instead to assure our energy and economic security. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang about whether China is burning. Straight ahead.
Went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by our duty expert on Asia. He is Gordon Chang. You see him on Fox News frequently and read his materials, I hope, at foxnews.com and also his superb columns at forbes.com and worldaffairsjournal.com, among other places. Gordon, you have been writing a lot and thinking hard about something we spoke about with General Jerry Boykin at the top of the program, namely China's efforts to pose a military, if unconventional in some cases, but nonetheless increasingly effective threat to our forces and capabilities to project power in the region, and even to our civilian economy as well. Cyber warfare being one of those tools, and there's this report that Bill Gertz, our colleague at the Washington Free Beacon, filed over the weekend about Chinese hackers getting into the highly secretive military office in the White House responsible for ensuring the president is connected to our nuclear deterrent forces, the so-called nuclear football. What do you know about what's going on here, if not the particulars of this story by Bill Gertz, more generally, the threat that the Chinese are posing in the cyber domain?
Well, China's obviously got the most extensive program of cyber espionage and warfare in the world. And what we are doing is trying to play catch up, which is very difficult because we're not willing to acknowledge that the Chinese are behind this. But the other story here is that nuclear deterrence between the United States and China is breaking down. as some elements in the People's Liberation Army think that they can wage nuclear war against the United States and its allies. And that's the significance of this story over the weekend regarding the Chinese trying to hack into the football. Because basically we think, oh, the Chinese would never try to start a war, but there are some indications that the Chinese have been thinking of a surprise nuclear attack.
And one of the things, again, that we've visited about in the past that speaks to that growing confidence on their part is that they've gone to such extraordinary lengths and apparently with considerable effect to harden and conceal their nuclear forces, including in this so-called underground Great Wall complex of some 3,000 miles of tunnels. Is it the combination, Gordon, of their own buildup, maybe four different new ballistic missile systems and these underground shelters to conceal them, and their perception that they may be able to get into and otherwise further degrade an already obsolescing U.S. nuclear deterrent that is causing this kind of increasing bullishness, perhaps, on the part of the Chinese People's Liberation Army?
Well, it's all of the above, Frank. But I think the most important element is the Chinese perception that we lack the will to defend ourselves. I mean, we believe, and I think quite rightly, in some sense, that our nuclear deterrent is fearsome. But the Chinese believe that we may not be willing to use it. Going back a couple years ago, a retired Chinese general blurted out in public in Hong Kong's South China Morning Post that China was thinking of a surprise nuclear attack against the United States. And this is so much against what we think our forces are fearsome, but the Chinese look at it very differently than we do, and we need to start thinking a little bit Chinese. Because really, when the question of deterrence is not what we think, but is what they think.
Right. And that's such an important point. And to the extent that we may find it unimaginable to actually contemplate starting a nuclear war for whatever purpose, they may feel differently, especially if, as a result of some of the modernization programs that we were just talking about, Gordon Chang, they've actually amassed far more capability than we know, which, again, can further undermine deterrence. Gordon, let me turn to another subject. You've written about, quite provocatively, Is China Burning? A look at what's going on inside China in connection with, but perhaps very much being influenced by, the recent set to with the Japanese over the Senkakus. Tell us what's going on there and what conclusions you're drawing from it for China itself.
The Japanese administer a chain of barren rocks in the East China Sea, which the Japanese call the Senkakus and the Chinese call the Daoyus. China makes claim to them, which it formally issued in 1971. The Chinese right now are, for various reasons, starting to bring this to the forefront of the attention of the Chinese people, really making an issue of it. And the Chinese, of course, can't back down, largely because there's, of course, this latent sentiment against the Japanese because of historical antagonisms, but also because the Chinese political system right now is weak. And I think that essentially leaders there are trying to divert attention of the Chinese people away from some real problems at home. So what we have seen over the last 3 weeks really has been people in the streets. We've seen all sorts of anti-Japanese demonstrations. And this is starting to affect the Chinese economy, which is already extremely troubled because Japanese companies have had to shut their operations 2 weeks ago, which are now opened up again. But nonetheless, this is really concerning the Japanese because China's become a very much a part of their global supply chain and now an unreliable part of their supply chain.
Yeah. You would have thought they might have learned that lesson from what happened to them a year or so ago with the cutoff of access to rare earth minerals. But obviously, this is another form of economic warfare that the Chinese are all too willing to wield against them. Check out Gordon Chang's superb column on this subject at Forbes.com. Is China Burning? Gordon, you talked about China in a moment of political weakness. We've been seeing prominently displayed here in the West, stories about the trial of Bozhi Lai. Remind us what that story, kind of almost a soap opera in a way, is about, and what's the latest twist in the story, and what does it mean for the future stability of China?
At the beginning of this year, Bozhi Lai was China's most openly ambitious and charismatic politician. He's been stripped of his Communist Party post in the early part of the year. Now, a week ago, he was actually expelled from the party, and clearly he is going to be transferred to judicial authorities, which means he will be tried. Of course, he's going to be convicted, and this is a problem because he has many popular supporters in China, people who may not necessarily like Bozhi Lai himself, but nonetheless are using him as sort of a vehicle to express discontent against the current crop of leaders. And so this really portends real trouble in China as they put Bo down hard. We're going to see perhaps a trial before the 18th Party Congress, which is scheduled to begin on November 8th. And if that's indeed the case, they're going to try and wrap this up quickly. But I don't think that they can, because there are a lot of people in Chinese society who really want something different than what the Communist Party is offering them now. And they're using Bo as a way to sort of a wedge to try to change things in their country.
Mm. We also have his son, who is a Harvard-trained and quite articulate young man, speaking up from outside China in defense of his father, and perhaps being able to bring some pressure to bear against the regime as it contemplates cracking down, as you say, hard on Bozhi Lai. What does that mean for this drama? And again, where do you think this goes from here, Gordon Chang?
Bo Guagua is probably in the United States right now. He just graduated from the Kennedy School at Harvard after getting a degree at Oxford. He has been talking recently of trying to defend his father. It's not clear what he will be able to do at this point, but nonetheless, there is a rallying point that we can think about, and that is that many people are using Bo, as I mentioned, and now they sort of maybe can glom onto his son, who is still quite young. But nonetheless, this shows that this drama is not over yet. Bo Guagua has a lot to lose if his father is imprisoned, and clearly his mother's already imprisoned. So this is something that's going to continue.
It will indeed, and we will be following it closely, not least, Gordon Chang, because of what it suggests, Bo being a rather a virulently anti-American figure, and the people who support him may have that sentiment as well. And at the very least, what it portends, as you say, for the internal dynamics at a critical moment in the transition to a new generation of leaders in communist China. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, Gordon, it's great to visit with you, and we'll look forward to doing so again next week, and we will look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.